L.C. When that robot voice comes in, you know it is time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to
E.L.C.
Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks and sneaks, using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, maybe you're in the afterglow of WrestleMania. Maybe you just watched the show and now you're tuning in. Now you want to hear your favorite video game podcast. Whatever the case, we're going to be in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. Those fine folks bring the show to you because they're supporting it. They're making it possible through their donations, but oh, they get perks. They get extra stuff. They get cool goodness for supporting the show and making sure the show continues, including ad-free versions of the show, video versions of the show on demand, extra content. So much extra content, including Feeling This, the show with Alex Solman and Christian Spicer. You got two seasons of that. You got spoiler chats. You got bonus content. You got the Wednesday paid DLC program with Lana Bashinsky and myself and Christian Spicer all hanging out, talking nonsense. Last week, we had Danish Syed swing by, talking all kinds of fun stuff. It's a great time. And you can get it by supporting the show at patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, well, it's the show all about games in their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata. That's spelled with two N's and one T. And I am joined, as always, by my friend slash co-host slash nemesis, the guy who's starting a new era, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Jeff. Hello, everyone. Unfortunately, it is the same era. I do have an announcement to make. I did not win the Powerball drawing. I really
That's
thought
why
I
you're
was
here still. That's why you're yeah, still I, here. Yeah.
I really. Ooh, it felt
now, here's
good.
The question. If you had one, would you still show up just to rub it in my face, or would you just have peaced out so fast that there would literally just be a cloud outline of you like in the cartoons?
This is a great question, and I don't mean it as a tease to our audience or like a push towards Patreon, but I have a longer answer for that I probably will save for a Wednesday show, because I have it all thought out, Jeff.
Wow.
I really thought I was going to win.
Yeah, that's funny that, you know, you had a real good feeling about it.
That was 10 bucks. Yeah.
Bad news for you, good news for us. Christian Spicer's, well, yeah, medium news for us, I guess.
Yeah, maybe,
hey,
maybe.
We do have good news for us, though, ladies and gentlemen. We got a big show for you. We got all kinds of really interesting news to get to. Stuff percolating, some really interesting studies, some interesting industry news about the video game industry, and also some really cool video games to talk about. We got some hidden gems for you, ladies and gentlemen. It's a hidden gem week on DLC. And we have an awesome guest to do it with. You know that DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, once again, we have the only guest up till now that has submitted their own DLC. And that is Dedicated Learner of Children. Because we have the editor-in-chief of the Gaming Outsider podcast and website, as well as fourth grade teacher at Maud E. Johnson School. It's Scott L. Clark back with us. Hey, Scott.
Hey, how's it going, Jeff and Christian? It is so awesome to be here. I will say I did not win Powerball either, but I got the next best thing, and that is getting a chance to talk with you guys on DLC Podcast. So here I am.
Aww. My wife asked me if she wanted, she's like, do you think we should play the Powerball? And I was like, no. But I bet if I had said yes, we would have won.
Yeah. Is it like over $1 billion I saw on the sign?
It was 1.3 billion. Someone in Oregon, I think. Yeah.
One? Someone in Oregon won?
Someone won.
Wow.
Not this guy.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Anyway, congrats if you're listening. Congrats, new billionaire.
If you're listening.
Also, maybe throw a little thing at the Patreon for us.
You can afford it.
Yeah.
As long as it doesn't put any financial burden on you.
Yes, yes. We wouldn't want anyone to support the show if it causes any financial burden. But if you have just become a billionaire, maybe consider the hype train level. I don't know. All right. Well, let's get into the show because we got a lot to get to. So let's start the way we always do with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You can always support. You can always suggest. I'm still thinking about the billionaire helping us out. You can always suggest stories of the week by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. That's also where you can send comments, questions, anything you'd like us to know. Boy, we love hearing from you at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. But that's not the only way. You can also participate in the community by hanging out in our Discord, which is 5x5 DLC on Discord. Great folks hanging out, talking all sorts of topics, not just video games, but all sorts of stuff. So I urge you to take part. But Scott, you are our guest. You get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
It is impossible to not talk about Prince of Persia for me. Lost Crown to this day is still my favorite game of the year. It was so good. Everything that I wanted in that style of game. And the fact that we may be getting, or we are getting a new one, at least in early access from the developers of the Dead Cells DLC. I'm a little torn because I love the format of the last game. This one's going to be a roguelike, which I love rogues. Don't get me wrong. I'm just curious how that's going to work in terms of you know, sticking to what we love about Prince of Persia, but in that gameplay format.
Yes, we have not gotten an official reveal of this game, but evidently this is happening. Insider Gaming reported that a spinoff studio of Motion Twin, which is called Evil Empire, is behind this next Prince of Persia iteration. These are the folks that did the Dead Cells DLC and some of the later updates to Dead Cells. And they're going to be calling this the Rogue Prince of Persia. And that it will, as you mentioned, be a roguelite of some capacity. And, you know, we've come so far from the years that we went through of no Prince of Persias, no Princes of Persia releases. We haven't had a Prince of Persia in, what, 6-7 years? Not a good Prince of Persia longer than that. And now we have what, you know, many consider, including people on this very podcast, Scott, and I know Christian, you believe Prince of Persia: The Lost Crown is a big game of the year contender already in 2024, and there will be another Prince of Persia released, at least in early access, this calendar year. We don't know when exactly, but my question to you, Scott, as somebody who's a big fan of The Lost Crown, and sounds like, you know, you're very much anticipating this game. Is there a risk? Is this too much Prince of Persia too quickly? Is there a risk of now kind of muddying the waters of people like, oh, didn't I just play a Prince of Persia? And it was really great. Do I need another Prince of Persia?
That's a really tough question to ask, because I would say if it were going to be more games like The Lost Crown, absolutely not. Bring more of that for sure. My worry is that jumping into something that is completely different, are people that are still high on Lost Crown going to jump in because the name Prince of Persia is attached to it and expect that, and instead it's going to be a roguelike, which, again, I love that genre. You're the reason I got into Rogue Legacy to begin with and like became obsessed with that game. You know, I love the formula, but how is that going to work? You know, Prince of Persia to me is very much about the puzzle rooms. It's about the, you know, the traversal, which I, you know, if you play Dead Cells, there's a lot of that in there as well. But I don't think it's enough. I think it's been long enough of a gap that having two games in one year is not going to be too much. We'll just have to see what happens in 2025, because if it does well.
Yeah. Christian, huge fan of The Lost Crown, as I was as well. And that said, not the hugest fan of roguelites. I think that's not your favorite genre. You often have a hard time kind of wrapping your arms around a roguelite. Is there, that said, you also loved Dead Cells. So you're an enigma. mystery. What do you make of this? We haven't got the official reveal, so we don't know exactly what it looks like, or, you know, we don't know if this kind of has that pixel art look of Dead Cells. I suspect it won't, but maybe. Maybe by the time people listen to this, we'll get a full reveal. Supposedly early next week, there may be a full reveal of this game. But are you excited about more Prince of Persia, having come off of really a high watermark for the franchise so soon?
I am excited about more Prince of Persia. Spoiler alert for this very podcast. We'll be talking about more Prince of Persia later this episode. I'm very curious about the explosion of the rogue type game. I mean, it's certainly not a new phenomenon, but it is one where that train has not slowed down, it seems like. And also a spoiler perhaps for games we'll be talking about later on this very episode. I do think a revitalized brand can go a long way to get eyeballs on a genre that is otherwise very crowded. And Prince of Persia is having a moment again that it hadn't in a very long time. So I think, you know, as Mark from marketing, it seems like it makes a lot of sense. A new studio spun off of an existing studio that did incredible work within the rogue type genre. Also, this subset of the studio already worked with an established IP and doing the Castlevania DLC for Dead Cells that I thought was a really, really great implementation of combining those two games, because Castlevania also is kind of known for its Metroidvania-esque style exploration and not so much of every time you do it, it's different. And I think the way that Castlevania and Dead Cells came together was a nice mixing of those two worlds, you know, very much paying homage to what Castlevania is, and the way that you get to the Castlevania levels had a feeling of what Castlevania was and as you explored through them, but then maintaining the essence of Dead Cells as well. So I feel like there's a lot of pedigree here for this to be a hit. I do wonder if it will be a hit for me personally, though, because I still do have a hard time with, am I progressing or am I just unlucky? Am I lucky or am I progressing? So I'm very curious to see what style of game this is. But I think if The Lost Crown has proven anything at this point, it's that the Prince of Persia can be many genres and be excellent at them. And so I'm excited. I think this makes a lot of sense. And the last thing I have to say about it is Ubisoft has never met a console, a genre, a whatever, that they're not willing to try once. You know, like VR will do that. Wii U, day one.
I think that's cool. I've always appreciated that about Ubisoft. But I also think it's interesting. You bring this up, and I think it bears underscoring, which is, I think it's cool that things that sort of gain a little momentum in the indie scene can blossom up and then be applied to known IP. You know, I think it's kind of neat. And I think what is neat about that is that, as you said, shines a spotlight on stuff that's kind of innovative and cool and happening on a, I think on a maybe less mainstream or less known level of the industry. And then you get these kind of bigger IP that are, who knows how big Prince of Persia is today. I don't know if it's, you know, it's not Call of Duty, but I think it's bigger than a lot, you know, bigger than Dead Cells was when it launched, certainly. And I think it's cool to have these kind of, you know, have these larger companies apply legacy IP to these more interesting things that are happening, riskier takes on games that indie studios are able to do. And I'm all for taking a franchise, especially one like Prince of Persia, that's been a lot of different things over its lifetime and kind of hasn't been in the zeitgeist for a while, and taking risks with it, doing different things. And even in the same calendar year, go for it. Do this one kind of game and do this other kind of game and let them both live. I hope that it doesn't cannibalize itself. Like, I think that can only go one direction, right? The Lost Crown can only cannibalize this one, because Lost Crown has already done what it's going to do. But, you know, I think this is a mostly positive development, and I think it's cool that this franchise that hasn't seen iteration in quite some time is getting these kind of different takes, these riskier games. And I'm all for it. I can't wait to see how this looks. I hope visually it's as daring and interesting as the concept seems to be, because Lost Crown, I think, sort of hit the pinnacle of what I want from a 2D, you know, animated looking Prince of Persia game. Like, that looked awesome. So like, do something else, try something else, try a different take. If it's pixel art, that's great. If it's something else, that'd be even cooler. I want it to be very different and not be visually confused with Lost Crown as well. But I'm looking forward to it. And again, we're supposed to hear maybe next, as early as next week.
I heard April 10th. I think it's at an indie event called, I want to say, Triple I Interactive or something like that. Which
these Triple I games. Yeah. So by the time some folks are listening to this, it may have already come out. I mean, we may already know exactly what this looks like. Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
Okay, I know the story I want to talk about. Whether or not it's the biggest story of the week or not, we're too far out to know yet. But I'm fascinated by all things that have been changing because of Europe, kind of like Microsoft's business model largely changed because of Europe. The same
French toast.
From the people who brought you French toast and USB-C as the standard plug on cell phones comes Apple easing its App Store policy. The announcement we got this week is that Apple has updated its guidelines to allow for classic console emulation apps to exist on the App Store. Previously, that has not been allowed. You'd have to jailbreak your iOS device, or there were browser-based alternatives. There were other ways to do it that didn't require a jailbreak, but in terms of going into the App Store, which in the United States is still the one and only official iPhone App Store, but perhaps by the time you're listening to this, they will have announced those changes too. It's all kind of unpeeling this onion of Apple's control over the device, but they're now allowing these classic console emulation apps. They have existed in the Google Play Store or any of your various Android, quote unquote, official stores for a long time now. Part of the reason I think this is so interesting to be happening now, alongside the EU regulations and legislation that is kind of forcing this change to happen, is this is happening now on the back end of Nintendo very successfully suing a Switch emulator out of existence. And so we're kind of in this convergence point of allowing these things to exist, but still not sure what world they exist in. To pull a Jeff, sister point, Sarah Bond announced that Microsoft is working on preserving a team to preserve legacy games and forward compatibility on Xbox. And I think it's a very fascinating inflection point in gaming history that we're going through right now of accessibility good or access good, but the way you do it is bad because we're not selling it to you. And I'm super curious where Apple ends up on this.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a lot of really interesting.
Yeah, it's a mess.
It's a mess. The, you know, I think the Switch emulator is kind of a edge case in that it's the current console.
Right.
This isn't retro. This isn't all classic games that maybe are not monetized in other ways right now. It's play Tears of the Kingdom on your PC. And probably you didn't pay for that, you know? So I can understand why Nintendo is like, especially because literally in the court case, they had this data about how many hundreds of thousands of copies of Tears of the Kingdom evidently were pirated and used on the emulator. So, I mean, it's not unrelated, but I do think it is—it's its own thing in a certain sense. I think this is really fascinating. I mean, in Apple's guidelines for doing this, they're like, "Hey, by the way, you got to be responsible. If you're putting this thing out, you got to be responsible for checking all the rights and making sure you're able to do this." You know, we're still going to slap your wrist if you do anything untoward here. Or
from the app store that brought you Flappy Bird, Flappy Cat, Flappy Owl, Flappy yeah. Other Bird, Flappy Thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what makes it even more confusing is just emulation in general. I'm a collector. I actually just recently finished my NES loose cart collection. I've got every US NES game in my shelf over there. I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that to be like emulation, from what has been explained to me, was originally designed for people that have games for a collection, but they want to be able to play them without having to use the actual physical media. So you rip the software, put it on your emulator, play it there so you can play it as much as you want safely without worrying about wear and tear on the originals. But then
that's
murky.
That's the explanation. That's more often than not what's being done, but I think you're right. That's the legal way we want to be doing it.
Right. Yes. And then I was talking to my co-host about this very story earlier today on our podcast, and he enlightened me and about the fact that you're not even, like, from a legality standpoint, you're not even supposed to download these games. For it to be 100% legal, you were supposed to rip your own copy, put it up on your hard drive, and then emulate it through the software. Right. So this brings up so many questions to me. How is this going to be tracked? How is this going to be made sure, you know, we as consumers or the developers are responsible for making sure that it is Apple washing their hands and saying, we are not responsible for whatever. You do what you're going to do, but we are not liable whatsoever. I don't know how it's going to work.
Well, I think there's going to be a subset of games, and they already exist. There's a whole lot of games that you can just play in your browser right now that are, for all intents and purposes, just surrendered to the public domain. And I think there's a huge library of those that can show up as an app on the App Store and let you do that. It's where you get into, like, Metroid on the NES, not so much. You know, Nintendo likes monetizing that backwards compatibility. And they have an emulator on their console that they want you to pay a monthly fee to use. So I don't think you're going to find that legally available magically on your iPhone. Mm-hmm. And so I think if people are hearing this news and being like, oh, I'm going to be able to play all the Super Nintendo games on my iPhone, probably not.
Probably yes, but
well, you can now, right now. You know, if you want
somebody's
to,
doing it
hard enough, you know.
Yeah.
I remember when I first got, I don't even know if it was the first iPhone, but it was one of the first iPhones. I think there was a couple of generations there early on where I was like, jailbreaking is the way to go. I haven't jailbroken an iPhone in, I don't know, a long time. But you know, those first few years, it was like, jailbreak, you can't believe what this thing can do. And then, yeah, you play all manner of craziness on it. But I think, Christian, you're right to bring up, in correlation with this, the news out of Xbox, which, again, is something else we're likely to hear more about later this summer when Xbox does their not E3 presentation. But this was an internal email that, correct in attributing to Sarah Bond, circulating through Microsoft and saying, we have now created a dedicated team whose sole job is to shepherd games from one generation to another, to ensure that this backwards compatibility exists, to be preservers of games. Games preservation is their number one task. And I think that is really an interesting thing for a company of that size to be doing. And I think, I mean, Scott, I think you're a perfect person to talk about this with because you are such a collector. Do you collect those games to play or do you collect those games to own?
If you ask my wife, she's going to have a different answer than I do, probably. She hates that collection so much. But for me, it started out as like kind of a joke. When I started to collect it, I was like, hey, it'd be kind of fun to collect all of them before I knew how many there were. And it'd be, you know, and then it just kind of kept snowballing and snowballing and snowballing. So I have them there to play. I can't tell you the last time I actually pulled out a cart and actually played it.
Right.
It's more for it was more of a checklisty item thing.
Sure.
For me.
Yeah.
When I play games, I used to love the old Assassin's Creed where you just had checklist things to check off. I love checking off things and having a physical collection that allowed me to do that. And then when I have people over and I get to show it off, hey, look at this. And they'll be like, I didn't know I had that there were this many games in the collection. And I get to show them the really expensive one. And I remember this game. And so it's a little bit of both, but mostly for the display. And I try to convince my wife it's for investment. I'm going to, you know, resell this in retirement. And
there you go. Yeah.
It's not going to happen. Come on.
Well, hey, I'm not disparaging that impulse at all. I think the completionist collector impulse is alive and well in myself and in Christian, and we understand it. There's nothing wrong with it. But
I mean, there is something wrong with it, but I also partake in it. But I'm not going to sit here and I'm not going to lie to Scott or myself and say there's nothing wrong with it. I've seen my garage. There's definitely something wrong with it. Lying to myself
is a big part of the whole thing. It's kind of part of it. It's interesting to me how big a deal this is for the industry as a whole, how much, you know, backwards compatibility is touted in these next consoles. And I don't know how many people actually really genuinely want to be able to play old stuff. That said, that kind of leads into my story of the week, but I don't want to go there quite yet. I think this is fascinating, and I think it's kind of cool that you'll be able to play old games on your iPhone and you'll be able to get these emulators, you know, right there in the App Store. I certainly will probably download this or that, you know, play an old, you know, text-based adventure game or some cool thing just to walk down memory lane on my iPhone. I think that's awesome. And I'm glad that this is – that Apple has been forced into this kind of thing. And I also think it's cool that Microsoft is – pushing for this on a company-wide level, that we aren't going to lose these things that we've all grown up with, that there's somebody kind of thinking about that. So I think this is ultimately a positive thing. And even though I don't know if people are really going to, you know, are really clamoring to play old, you know, technologically obsolete games.
Well, it's interesting. You keep bringing up game preservation, you know, from an emulation standpoint. And I feel like a lot of people really lean on game preservation as the purpose for emulation. But to me, that's an excuse for, I just want to play these games and without paying for them. You know what I mean? Yeah. I've gotten into arguments with coworkers about I'll admit it. I've downloaded movies and downloaded some stuff back in the day. You know, back when I was younger and before I kind of understood the damage and the kind of thing that
we all had Napster.
Oh, know? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But I have to, not me.
No,
it's too young, Christian. Too young. You're too young.
No, but I mean, I've had arguments with coworkers about that pirated movies. And I'm like, you can't do that. That's stealing. Well, no, it's not stealing. I'm like, would you go take something from a store and then put it? Well, no, but it becomes mine. Like, how is that not stealing? Like, so, like, I think that the majority of people that are using emulators are wanting to play these games that they don't have to, like, search out. Because let's be honest, as a collector, I can tell you, getting a hold of some of these games, like a physical copy of it, is getting nuts, guys.
The counter argument to what you're saying is exactly that, which is there's really, for most people, there's no way to buy or pay for a lot of the stuff that will be available here, right?
Right.
And you're not paying it to the people who made it.
Exactly.
Exactly. Like the when you're tracking down an old cart, the money you spend for it isn't going to any of the people that made that cart.
Right.
Right. It's going to some guy who happens to have found it at a garage sale somewhere and put it on eBay. Right.
Right.
So, I think you make a good point, but it's also there's a difference between, hey, I want to play, you know, Super Metroid and I don't want to give Nintendo my monthly fee, to I want to play this old game that just you can't get anywhere else. There's nowhere to go and buy it. There's no service that allows me to even access it, but there is this way. So I'm more sympathetic to the sort of gray area there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's cool that basically this will give folks a way to kind of, you know, revisit some of that stuff that's in the, if not in the actual public domain, in the sort of pseudo public domain. Mm-hmm. I've certainly gone down the road of web-based, like, oh, cool. I played just the other day. I got into a conversation with Anthony Carboni about this old game, this old CG, the CGA, like three color PC game that both of us remembered called Alley Cat, which I'm sure no one remembers. There's no reason to ever remember it. You play as a little cat and you're like climbing up this, you're in this horrible alley with garbage on the ground and you're trying to climb in. And if you go into a window in these buildings, it opens up into a whole other level, which at the time was like mind blowing. And it's very primitive and bad, but you can play it right now. We Googled it and it was like, oh, you can play it in my browser. And I did. And I was like, oh, yeah, I remember. I played for, 4 minutes, got my fill of the nostalgia hit, and then peaced out. But there's no person I could go to pay for Alley Cat. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
I wonder if part of Xbox's positioning right now is, again, seeing the Nintendo piracy that's happening or happened, still happening, but with the Switch stuff more recently. And trying to see what an internal cost is to be the ones to preserve it, air quote, or make it readily accessible for these more recent older games that are, for better or worse, x86 architecture built games that they're able to relatively easily bring forward to future generations of consoles and create the iTunes in response to Napster, where I think everybody pirated right. music because it was easier to do it yeah. for so many people than it was to find a reasonably affordable and easy, safe way to get it. And Apple came in and was like, 99 cents. You know you're going to have the thing. It's going to work. You're not going to have to download 8 versions of it to see if this is the crappy version that Universal put out to, right. Get the thieves or whatever it is. And I think as things become available at a price that is acceptable, I wonder to what extent that eliminates that piracy market for most people, not everybody, but for the average consumer that's like, oh, I have my Xbox. I can play, what was like Bill Gates's favorite game? He like the Xbox One Fuse or no, whatever it was. I forget what it was. A listener knows, but like, some OG Xbox One game and it plays on my Xbox 20.
Yeah.
It's all there. So I don't need to go and Google to see if it works in this browser. I can just have it all there. And I think if they can do that internally for a cost that makes sense, I think there's a lot of value add to that. But I don't think we figured it out yet. This idea of preservation and access.
Well, the trajectory of this conversation that I don't think we want to go down now, but that I think is where this heads. If you're talking about game preservation, the real question mark now, it is one thing to talk about games from the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, but when it's like, oh, there's games that require a check-in to a server, and there's games that, everything that comes out now, like how do we preserve games now when in order to play them, there's an entire infrastructure on the back end, on the publisher side that must exist. It has nothing to do with me pushing play on my local computer or console. It's an entire other thing. What does game preservation in that world look like?
And it's simple. You just set up your own server at home and then,
you and your friends. Well, that's what I'm hoping Sarah Bond's team is thinking about. That's what I'm hoping those people are working about. Not just, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could all play King's Quest 3, but more like, well, hey, when we shut off the Destiny 2 servers in some year, are we going to be able to go back and play Destiny 2 in 2035? Who knows? Who knows?
I mean, look how many games now are just not available to play already. Because like the servers have been shut down, or they just don't support it anymore, or
2035 nothing next Friday,
right?
Yeah, I agree with you.
Fusion Frenzy, that was Bill Gates's infamous favorite game. He loved
Fusion Frenzy. It's a fun little multiplayer game. It's like a goofy kind of party game where it's all multiplayer stuff and in this neon look to it. Fusion Frenzy. I think there was like fireworks when you finished a level.
Four player. I remember a giant ball cage that you could roll around with your guy inside of it. Right?
All right. Before we get to my story of the week, we're going to take a quick break for a sponsor. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace! Ha ha! They're back, Christian! They're back! Squarespace, our old friend! oh, we love Squarespace so much. Hey, maybe they're back because DLCpod.com, the brand new DLCpod.com, is built on Squarespace.
Built on Squarespace.
You did it. You did it. You didn't even do it because they were going to sponsor us. We just used them because it's the best solution to the problem, right?
We need site. How to make site. Squarespace. Yes. Love it.
Squarespace. JeffCanada.com, built on Squarespace. DLCpod.com, built on Squarespace. Squarespace is the place, the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Whether you're just starting out or managing a growing brand, Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place and on your terms. There's so many great features of Squarespace. They've got Squarespace Blueprint AI and SEO tools, so you can start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system called Squarespace Blueprint. You choose from a professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Easily launch your website and get discovered fast with integrated, optimized SEO tools so you show up more often to more people and grow the way you want. Plus, you can make checkout seamless for your customers if you're selling stuff online. They got simple but powerful payment tools that accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay. In eligible countries, they even offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Plus, there's this Fluid engine, the Squarespace Fluid engine, which is the next generation website editor from Squarespace. So it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity. Choose your website starting point and customize every design detail with reimagined drag and drop technology for desktop or mobile. Stretch your imagination online with Fluid engine included in any new Squarespace site. It's just the best way to make a website. That's why we use it. That's why we used it to make our website. So head over to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/DLC to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Again, that's squarespace.com/DLC for 10% off. You can use our promo code DLC when you purchase a website or a domain. 10% off squarespace.com/DLC and promo code DLC. All right. It kind of leads into my story of the week, which is this fascinating, fascinating study that was just released. There's a company called NewZoo, which is an industry researcher group that puts out these kinds of industry-wide studies. And they just released some new data about the PC and console market for 2023, analyzing the market from the previous completed year. They said that the PC and console market grew 2.6%, which is pretty good. I mean, good that it's growing because we feel like the market is stagnating and there's all these, you know, insane layoffs pointing to that stagnation. But the craziest part of this study, the part that makes it a story of the week for me, is that according to their data, 60% of the total playtime that they analyzed across PC and consoles, 60% of gamers' total playtime in 2023 was spent on games that are 6 years old or older. 60%.
Well, so, you know why that is.
You know why that is?
What game came out over 6 years ago that is insanely popular right now?
Well, I mean, they list several of them.
No, I know.
It's Fortnite, Grand Theft Auto 5, Counter-Strike 2, Roblox, Minecraft, Rocket League, Apex Legends, Fall Guys, Valorant, and Call of Duty. Mm-hmm. These are the top time-spent franchises, and all of them, you know, Call of Duty obviously has an annual update, But other than that, these games are long tail games that have still captured huge audiences and are accounting for the lion's share of people's time. And then they say across Xbox and PlayStation consoles, only one dedicated single player game cracked the top 10 of hours spent. That game is Starfield. Kind of surprising to me, especially in a year where Baldur's Gate 3 is sort of dominating all the awards and all the talk. And it's certainly a big, long single player. Well, can play in multiplayer too, but a single long experience that I'm sure a lot of people put time into. Diablo 4 also came out 2023. But according to NewZoo, only 8% of video game playtime was spent on new non-annual titles like Diablo 4, Baldur's Gate 3, and others. 8% of the total video game playtime was on new non-annual games. Non-annual excludes Madden, excludes Call of Duty, excludes FIFA. Mm-hmm. So their conclusion was it will be, quote, increasingly challenging to grow a game's player base, particularly in our current landscape where evergreen titles or robust content pipelines reign supreme. This is why we're seeing more sequels, more remakes, annual entries in popular series, and games that want you to play them forever. My reaction to this is it's not good, personally. I think that's not good. We can argue that, and I want to have that discussion. But I also think that one of the reasons it's not good is precisely what I said, which is that everybody wants to be one of those few games. Everybody wants to be the game you play forever. And therefore, they're crafting games to be that and exactly making the situation where fewer games can exist because players are asked to make choices in that regard. You can't play all of those. You have to choose one to get married to. And in that environment, I think that domino effect of, okay, we want, you know, Suicide Squad Kills the Justice League to be your forever game. Oh, wait, no, it isn't. Okay, well, that's a massive failure. We're laying off people. And I think we're seeing that over and over and over again. These games that are intended to become these multi-year, long tail, evergreen games, instead of just being a great game in and of itself. And I think that sort of Ouroboros of a snake eating its own tail of like, oh, people are only playing the games that are old. Okay, let's make games that are like that. Oh, nobody wants to play that because they're playing the old games. Okay, well, that's all failing. Means why would I jump into a new game if the old game still has people, which creates the cycle over and over and over again. Self-fulfilling prophecy leads to thousands of layoffs. Discuss. Scott, what do you think? What do you make of this? Do you put most of your time into older games? Or are you playing more current stuff?
I'm trying to play the newest, latest, best, but that's also because I'm trying to keep up, you know, content for my show, and I also have. You've mentioned it on past episodes. I want to be part of the new thing. I like being part of the conversation when a new game comes out, and I like to be able to speak intelligently about that. So it was one of my New Year's resolutions, actually, for this year was to play a game not for review each month before I played a new game for review. You know, you kind of go back, whether I was revisiting an old game that I enjoyed or maybe pick up on a game that I just missed for some reason or the one that everybody's talking about. I just try to stick to that, because at the end of the day, gaming is about having fun, right?
Yeah.
The thing that stood out to me most about this story, though, is the fact that it pretty much proves that the whole console war garbage is just that garbage, that like this many people are playing these games that are available everywhere, not just on the one on the one console. So like everybody that gets up in arms about PlayStation is better than Xbox, Xbox is better than PlayStation, it truly doesn't matter. The numbers are right there proving that that people just want to play the game they like and they don't really care where it is. In terms of worrying about the future, I think I've kind of had this inkling that the single player story-based experience you know, could be seeing the beginning of the end, so to speak, which scares me because that's where I prefer to play. I don't play a ton of online games. Number one, I don't have the time to get good at them anymore. And my social experiences, I'd rather be playing a co-op game with a friend where we're working together towards something instead of something competitive. And I think that it's almost a generational thing where the upcoming generation is more interested in playing games together with their friends, where they're either teaming up against other people or they're teaming up against each other to see who is, you know, the biggest and the greatest at whatever this game is.
I think there's more than that. Just observing my 7-year-old and his, you know, we try to limit him on video games, but he's obsessed with them. And what draws him in, honestly, it seems to me, is an established level of community and content that is already around a game. The reason I like Minecraft is because everybody's talking about Minecraft and there is an endless amount of Minecraft content to discover.
Right.
So what you're competing with when you're a new game is the infinite introspection, discussion, YouTube channels that are about all these established games. Just recently, like in the last week, my son showed me this game I had never seen before. He's like, "Daddy, this is cool. It's this endless runner, this wild, like you can make your own levels. I can't remember what it's called. Like, I think it's called Geometry Dash. Anyway, I was excited about it. I was like, oh, maybe I'll bring it up on DLC and talk about it on the show. And I Googled it and it was released in 2010 or something like that.
Wow. Like,
I couldn't believe it. I never heard of it. It's a mobile first game, but there is so much content around it. There are all these, you know, thousands of user-made levels that you can, that have all been rated and discussed and talked about. And there's all these YouTubers that have tried to beat the hardest levels and all these things. And that is what he's interested in. He's interested in the rabbit hole of ancillary content around the game as much as the game itself. And I think that's where these established properties will always win, is they've just got endless avenues to explore. You can watch Minecraft content until the heat death of the universe at this point, right? Mm-hmm. There's no end to it. And I think that's a major part of what is drawing the young, or at least what I'm observing anecdotally with my 7-year-old. You know, again, he's not aware of the newest game to come out, but I also think he wouldn't care even if he was.
Well, similarly, I have experiences with my students. I taught remotely during COVID for an entire school year and, you know, got to know them virtually. And, you know, at lunch and recess and stuff, we'd take times and we'd play Among Us together or, you know, other games that we could all join in together. And the one that they always wanted me to play was Roblox. I had never played it before, knew nothing about it. And I would hop in there. They're not even playing a game in there, man. They're just existing together in a world and just like hanging out, talking, you know, pushing each other in a grocery cart and going through a grocery store and just laughing and carrying on.
Yeah.
Like that's how simple it is. And it's whatever's trending. It was Minecraft. That's still a thing, obviously. Fortnite, Roblox, all these things. It's just, I just worry that they're not going to want to do anything narratively. You know, I mean, I know that's selfish because I like the narratives in games. I like the story and the writing and the characterization and all this. And I don't hear any kids talking about the great stories in the games they're playing like I was when I was a kid.
I mean, it's even worse than that. I would argue that, you know, my 7-year-old is less interested in narrative, even in non-interactive entertainment. He would rather watch a YouTuber play Minecraft than a great Pixar movie or,
oh man,
you know, Star Wars. I can't talk my kid into watching Star Wars. He won't watch it. He's not interested. And wow. You know, he doesn't care about being told a story. He just wants to hang out with people doing something cool. And you can forever. There's infinite amount of being able to do that. Anyway, we're old. Christian, what do you think? 60% of games being played 6 years or older. What do we think? Death knell? Are we all, should we just walk out to the pasture now and lay down, stare into the sun?
Well, if you're listening to this, please use your eclipse glasses. Do not stare into the sun, even if it is an eclipse where you are. Please don't do that. Don't look directly into it. I'm not sure how much the pandemic played into this number. I think it accelerated it some, certainly, because we were all shut inside and looking for ways to still connect because we are social creatures. And these mature, established, well-made games provided that avenue very, very well. You know, Fortnite, whatever these games are, right? You're able to connect. We were able to play with each other. We were able to have some semblance of normalcy. And I think this would have happened anyway, but I think this particular 2023 timeline for an entire high school generation, that is how they got together. They didn't sit at the curb and skateboard and sit at the 7-Eleven and meet up at the movie theaters and go to the concert, not only because they didn't want to, but because for many of them, they could not. And so you've already trained this style of interaction and socialization, and it reinforced it. So I think that is a part of the number, if not a whole of the number. I also think that this isn't necessarily a new thing. Whether or not it is larger now than it was before, I mean, World of Warcraft is still the most played subscription-based MMO, and it came out however many years ago. How much of playtime actually was going to mobile games that isn't reported within the study. Like, I think that we oftentimes like to, but we get ahead of our skis and it's like, oh my gosh, PC gaming is dead. No one's going to PC game anymore. But the death, this is it. This is the death. Diablo 3, the final PC game to come out, you know, ring the bell. We're done. Never again. Never going to be this good. Console gaming is over. Kids don't play console games anymore. They're all on their devices. Single player narrative games are over. There aren't going to be any more of those. Elden Ring's a single player ass game. Yes, there's multiplayer aspects of it and, you know, summons and this, that, and the other. But that is a single player game that tells a story that is very popular and huge. Grand Theft Auto 6, I'm almost certain, is going to have a single player component that is going to be huge. I think this stuff is still happening. But I also very much agree with you, Jeff, that a lot of these older games now, I hope this doesn't come across as a knock to our friends at IGN, because it is not. But a lot of these older games now are the IGN of gaming, right? Like if you Google a game, IGN is going to be one of your first results, regardless of whether or not that particular piece of IGN content happens to be great. But it's because they've been doing it forever. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, it's pretty good. So, you know, the internet algorithm rewards that. And I think a lot of that bears true here as well with you're looking up games to play, things to do. A lot of these older games are going to be the things that YouTubers are doing because it's still getting the views, because it's still the thing that people are talking about. And it's a reason why Disney Plus is Marvel and Star Wars shows, because it's, you know, it's churning IP or mining IP is not a new thing. Disney has gone to court over it for years so that they can maintain theirs. So this makes sense to me. And I think that we are old, so it feels a little funny or weird. And as someone who also loves narrative games, Scott, I would argue that both of us need to look in the mirror and realize that the narrative in our old games weren't that good, even if we liked them.
Interesting. Well, and the good news is, even if it does ever stop, if the you know, narrative games just stop being a thing and it's all social or online stuff, I got plenty of games to catch up on, guys. I've got so many games I've never gone back and finished.
Let the industry collapse. I can go into my backlog.
Yeah.
Sarah Bond is making sure that games are preserved for the inevitable crash.
As long as I don't break my glasses, I'm good to go.
Sorry, I don't break my glasses.
I did have one other thing I wanted to address. You were talking about like games like Elden Ring, which, like you said, is a single-player experience. But I would also argue that I believe a lot of the popularity for that game was because of social media, because that game was so well received in short little clips, like on TikTok, you know, where people are watching this one little thing happen. And when that game came out and I'm scrolling through TikTok, it was like every fifth or sixth video was a Elden Ring something or other, or somebody playing it live. And I think that social, that online aspect helped drive sales for that game and kept it going as much as it did.
100%. Yeah. The other thing about this, if I want to try to be a little Pollyanna here, try a little silver lining, and you guys might laugh at this, but they also don't say how many hours 8% is. Mm. You know? Like, 8% is a small percentage, but it may be a tremendous amount of time. You know? It certainly is enough to make Baldur's Gate 3 a huge hit, right? And so maybe you're cutting up a smaller amount of that overall pie, but maybe there's enough room even in that small piece of pie for everybody to get, you know, a blueberry. It's a blueberry pie in my mind. One blueberry, it's delicious. It's still delicious.
So that's 8% of the game number, like copies sold. It's not 8% of the time.
This is time. We're talking time. They're not mentioning sales whatsoever. They're saying the amount of time spent, 23% of total playtime spent in 2023 was on new games that came out in 2023. So only 23% was on new games, which is actually, this is not even games that came out in 2023. That was defined as games 2 years old or younger. So even games that came out in 2022 are considered new games. So that's only 23% of total playtime was spent on new games. Of that, more than half was spent on big annual sequels like Madden, NBA, 2K, Call of Duty.
Right.
So games that are just, that just came out in 2023 or 2022 that aren't an annualized game, that just like even a big sequel like Diablo, Baldur's Gate, what have you, that accounts for only 8% of total playtime. So it might be a skewed metric in that, you know, I can play an infinite amount of Minecraft, but I'm only going to spend 10 hours on the single player campaign of what have you. So if we're talking play time, maybe it's not as doom and gloom as we're making out. I mean, there's still room for people to play those games and enjoy those games and purchase those games. I don't know. It does seem to be a crazy that 92% of the total time people spent in games was on games that didn't, that came out more than 2 years ago. 60% games came out more than 6 years ago. That's just wild to me. Wild.
It is nuts.
On that note, we'll take a quick break for another sponsor. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Green Chef. Green Chef is the number one meal kit for clean eating, delivering pre-portioned and prepped quality whole foods with limited processed ingredients. Green Chef sends organic, fresh produce, responsibly sourced proteins, and chef-designed recipes in every box for satisfying, nourishing, and convenient meals that make it easy to stick to a clean routine. Christian, I know you have a pretty restrictive diet, right? You are vegetarian, and I'm sure that can be challenging on a day-to-day basis with your family, yes?
We were joking about it before we started the show about the trials and tribulations sometimes of being a vegetarian. And I feel like sometimes when we're having friends over, it's like, oh, what are you guys going to make for dinner? It's like, oh, it's this vegetarian dish. And my friend's like, but then I don't even bother with that. I'm like, oh, we're making something from Green Chef. And everybody's like, woohoo.
Yeah. And they have
great.
All kinds of different meal kits to suit any lifestyle, with keto, plant-based, Mediterranean, gut and brain health categories, calorie smart, quick and easy, protein packed, and gluten free. So if you're conscious about what you're putting in your body, what you're serving to your family, Green Chef is the way to go. And you can choose. That doesn't mean, that does not mean that the selection is limited, because every single week you choose from over 80 flavor packed options. Are you like me, Christian, where like it takes more time for you to decide what you want because there's like 18 different ones that you want every week? It's
are you asking if I suffer from analysis paralysis? Because right now I'm not sure how to answer that question because I'm trying to reorganize all the decisions I need to make.
Well, the good news is you'll get that time back because you'll get it back in your kitchen. You can make dinner in 30 minutes and lunch in 10 with the Green Chef meals. And Green Chef delivers everything you need to make it convenient, wholesome, and delicious every time. It's got pre-measured ingredients. Some even have pre-chopped ingredients and custom sauces that are pre-made in-house. So you know what you're putting into your mouth. You know what you're putting into your family's mouths. I like that. I love the fact that I'm making the food for my family, but it's still not going to take me forever. I don't have to rush to the grocery store. I get everything I need right there in the box. Go to greenchef.com/DLC50. And use promo code DLC50 to get 50% off, plus 20% off your next 2 months. Again, that's greenchef.com/DLC50 and promo code DLC50 to get 50% off, plus 20% off your next 2 months. Green Chef, the number one meal kit for eating well. All right, we have some interesting games that we have been playing this week. So let's get into our playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on the playlist. Spoiler alert, none of Scott's games are more than 6 years old.
A true story.
But you have a lot of really interesting ones, including one you pointed out to me that I played. We can wait on that or start there, wherever you'd like to start. You have a lot of really cool, I think, perhaps hidden gems that some folks may not have heard about.
Sure. I mean, I've been playing pretty much what everybody else has been playing. I finished Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. I'm still playing through Baldur's Gate 3, but you mentioned single player. I am playing that game exclusively multiplayer.
Oh,
with my producer, actually. We get together for about 5 or 6 hours every Sunday morning and do that. Absolutely loving that. But the brand new games I've been playing, the first one is a game called Beat Slayer, which is a rogue. So I thought it might perk your interest a little bit. Mm-hmm. But this one is really interesting because it is completely rhythm-based. So you play as this female character that is trying to rescue her brother from an evil corporation that is brainwashing the city. And you do so by working your way through various levels, destroying robots to fight your way through to reach the final boss and rescue him. But the hook of this game is that the city is being brainwashed by this music that is being blasted all over the city. And so our character puts on her own headphones and kind of lives life by her, you know, the beat of her own drum, so to speak. So she's listening to her own music. And when you're fighting all these robots, you have to do so in beat with the music. So you have an attack, you have a dash, you have a kick, which stuns enemies, and you have like a special attack, which you have to like kind of work your way up to. It's got like three different, you know, bars that you deplete, and you kind of work your way up there. But the game rewards you for landing consecutive hits on time with the music. So once you hit like 20 hits in a row, you go into this like bonus mode or hyper mode where now your attacks are actually doing more damage. So it takes a while to wrap your head around because you're so used to just button mashing your way through melee games. And in this one, you're actually doing it on beat and you're dashing. And the enemies have this telegraph look to them once you start learning their patterns, so that you know exact right time to dodge them and how many times you have to dash. And it becomes this dance around all these enemies. My co-host Zach loves the Arkham games. And because he talks about how that combat feels like a rhythm game almost, because you get into this rhythm. This game is solely that from front to back, and it's awesome. Like I said, it's a rogue, so you're going to die. You're going to come back, and you're going to earn some new upgrades and work your way through. And there's actually even more. Once I completed a run, and then it kind of extends the story a little bit and has reasons for you to go through it four more times and a fifth time and all that. It's very charming. The music is great. My only issue with this game is some of the dialogue from the main character gets a little annoying. She has some, she just loves one-liners. So she literally says in one time, and I think I actually rolled my eyes when she said this. She's like, "I'm here to kick butt," and that's it. Like using the infamous funny. Duke Nukem or They Live line.
That's funny.
It's funny, but when you hear it four or five times, it got so annoying. I actually went into the settings and turned down the audio, just the dialogue down to like the, so I could still hear it, but it wasn't blasting in my ears because I wanted to hear the music. It was keeping me from being able to focus on the music. But it is a lot of fun. The upgrades feel good. Like just the feeling of dancing around your enemies and getting the right attacks in and staying on beat is great. And you're not penalized if you miss one of the beats of a four beat measure. You know what I mean? So like I can attack, as long as I do the attack, I'm fine. If I don't do one and I just walk around the map, I'm not penalized.
One of the things you didn't mention is this is an isometric game.
Yes.
And so I think people might be imagining something similar to Hi-Fi Rush, and it feels almost like it's isometric Hi-Fi Rush, right?
That's how I felt when I started playing it, and it's interesting because I'm one of the few that didn't land with Hi-Fi Rush, but I landed completely with this one. I don't know what it is. Maybe it being in 3D was an issue for me, and I don't know why, because I'm not like afraid of 3D games or anything. It just, this clicked with me way more than Hi-Fi Rush did, but that's a very apt way to describe it.
Again, this game is called Beat Slayer. It looks like on Steam right now, it's only $18. Looks pretty cool. Just looking at a video on Steam here, it looks like Hi-Fi Rush, as the beat goes, the environment is also changing.
Yes.
So as you're timing it, you know, ramps are going up and down. Very much looks like isometric beat Hi-Fi Rush, which... not a bad thing at all.
Taking Hi-Fi Rush and Hades and putting it all together.
Yeah. Very cool. Also on your playlist is a game that you recommended to me this week, knowing that you were coming on. And boy, was it an excellent recommendation. This is not a game that I had heard about. It just came out. It's called Mini Shoot Adventures. And I'd describe this as what if Geometry Wars and The Legend of Zelda had a baby.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. The way I described it in my review was, imagine Legend of Zelda, but instead of being a little guy in a green tunic, you're a sentient spaceship shooting bullets.
Yeah, this is something we're seeing a lot with indie games, and I just love it. I absolutely love it. It's really innovative to take two very disparate genres that are well-established and we know kind of how they work, and then slam them together. And we've seen example after example of this, but I've never seen the sort of old school Zelda adventure game mashed up with a bullet hell shooter. And that's what you get with Mini Shoot Adventures. It's such a smart and well executed mashup of two really different styles.
It's fantastic. It's a kind of unfortunate that I can only find it on PC right now. I feel like it's going to make its way to at least Switch sometime in the future. I just can't imagine it's going to just sit on PC. I'm not knocking PC. I'm playing it on my Steam Deck. But the exploration is so rewarding. It really feels like you're playing an old school. I'm not talking Tears of the Kingdom. I'm not talking Breath of the Wild. I'm talking like, let's go find out what's behind, you know, in this cave and explore that and see what upgrade I'm going to get. And it feels very satisfying. And
It's like more like a Link to the Past, or
yes,
even like a Minish Coat or Minish Cap, I should say. It's that old school, like top down Zelda where, you know, the top of the screen looks like a wall, but if you get close enough to it, ooh, maybe there's a little way through there and I could go and find some hidden piece of heart.
Right. And one of my favorite aspects of it is the upgrade system that they've got in it, because when you know, destroy other spaceships, because there's no animals, they're all spaceships that you're fighting against.
Yeah.
You know, you get these little red gems that act as experience points, and you allocate them into I almost don't even want to call it a skill tree. I mean, it is, but it's not, you know, plus 2% damage or anything like that. It is, you want your bullets to go faster, you want your bullets to do more damage, you want your bullets to, or you want your ship to move faster, and you just plug them into all of these various pieces. But you can respec those at any time you want to. I was literally respecing my spaceship in the middle of a boss fight. which I don't know a game that lets me do that. Sure, it'll let me respec like back at my home hub or whatever, but I can't pause the game and respec. You can do that here, and I love that. You can even, when you're fighting a boss, because the bosses are true bullet hell. Like, they're get some crazy combinations in here.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is these bosses have phases, you know, or different forms. So they kind of break down. And each time you do that, it actually gives you a little bit of experience. So even if you're struggling with a boss, you don't necessarily have to go out into the real world and grind to get some experience. Just keep trying that boss. Yeah. And as long as you get a couple forms here and there, you're going to level up. That's very generous about getting those levels up to you in a way that make it not impossible to play.
I agree. The leveling up process is really well done. You can totally just farm the environment and keep doing the same thing. It doesn't want to restrict you. It's like, if you want to play it that way, go for it. And it's really satisfying. All the animations are satisfying. Mm-hmm. The shooting is very satisfying. It's very palpable when you level up one aspect of your ship. You can definitely feel the difference. Yes. Oh, I am doing more damage. Oh, I am shooting more frequently. Oh, I am going faster. And you get really cool upgrades. But also, you're doing Zelda stuff. You're like going into a dungeon and you have to collect keys and go from room to room and figure out a little puzzle. And you're doing Zelda stuff in the context of flying around as a ship and avoiding all the bullets that are filling up the screen, you know, R-type style.
Exactly. And then the game is really gear-gated as well. So, like, you'll earn new abilities that you acquire either right before or inside those dungeons, which will open up new sections of the map to you. You know, so you're constantly doing that checklisty. I got to go back to this area when I get that gear later on. Like, even after you finish the game, it's just so much fun to go explore and try to get all the points on the map just to see what's there and see what ways the game throws at you to uncover them. I'm absolutely in love with mini shoot adventures.
I agree with you. I'm so glad you pointed this one out to me. It's a two-person development team. So two people made the whole game. I love the music. I love the art style. It communicates things very efficiently, very clearly. It does have that kind of Geometry Wars simplicity of, you know, ships are basically triangles or, you know, basic shapes. But in that, it's always communicating to you, you know, they will change color as you damage them more. So you know that this one is a little closer to being able to, you know, defeat. It's very efficient and clear with the player about every aspect of it. And I think there's an elegance there that I really admire. This game, I really am taken with it. And yeah, great on Steam Deck. It's called Mini Shoot Adventures. Mm-hmm. Christian, I think you'd really like this game too.
Yeah, it's been on my radar and I just haven't had a chance to, you know, set it up and run it yet. But I also like that it's bright and cheery and it's not doing all of it in like, you're not in a dark space.
Yeah.
Hell, you know, it definitely has that Minish Cap era or Link to the Past, as you said, like a color palette, which I love.
Yeah. All right. What else is on your playlist, Scott?
I got another game I actually played today, started a game today called Mighty Mage, and I finished it today, which sounds like a good thing. Maybe not. This is I'll talk very briefly about this one because I'm going to be honest. I was not a big fan of this game. I love Vampire Survivors. This looked like it was going to be a Vampire Survivors clone, and it kind of is. You play as a mage that has a choice of four different elemental magic to use, and then it's just wave-based. It is 15 waves of enemies that come at you. You clear the wave, you pick a new selection, you move on. I died my first run, and then that was the last time I died.
Wow.
I completed a run, and it gives me a one screen paragraph that says, thank you you have completed all the levels. You are now a true mage. Thanks for playing. And then it goes back to the title screen. I'm talking like 10 minutes in, you know, and then you do it three more times with each of the different elements. And I got a platinum trophy today in about 45 minutes. Well, so I feel like this is a missed opportunity, though, because I feel like there's something here. Because what sets this game apart gameplay wise is that you are attacking by casting spells. And whenever you're casting a spell, you have to open up a book and you have to conjure up whatever spell it is that you're casting. And then you've got whatever abilities you've acquired that each have a cooldown, but you don't manage them. They just go on their own. As long as you're holding down the attack button, you're opening the spell and they attack. But the downside of that is that whenever you are casting, your character runs extremely slow. So you don't have the ability to move and dodge while you're casting. So it's about getting your attacks in, dodging out of the way, and then repeating and doing that over again. I think there's something there with that. This is a $3 game. You know what I mean?
It's on sale right now for $1.15.
Yeah. And so I'm not going to super recommend it, but I wanted to bring it up because I think that there is something there. It just needs to be expanded on. It feels like a game that came out before Vampire Survivors, and that developer said, I can make that better. And you know what I mean?
I don't think that's the case, but
no, it's not. I'm just saying that's what it feels like. Yeah, this game is just like, you know, brand new. So yeah, Mighty Mage might want to stay clear of that one. But
my aforementioned 7-year-old came home from school one day and said, Daddy, do you know about survivor games? And I was like, oh, is he like, is he talking about, you know, where you have to chop down a tree and build your own house and collect, you know? And I was like, yeah, I know about it. What game are you talking about? He said, there's a game called Survivor.io. And it's basically vampire. I mean, it's a Vampire Survivor ripoff that's on iOS. And he's obsessed with it now. So my kid has discovered the Vampire Survivor games. I'm like, I know that. Yeah, your dad's cool. This is my Vampire Survivor was my favorite game of the year it came out. He's like, Dad, be quiet. Anyway, what else is on your playlist?
The other one is a game I really like called Kudzu, which is a new Game Boy game. You can actually get physical. Well, you can't now. They're really hard to find the physical copies of it, but they make a box. And, you know, this developer is made a new Game Boy game, but it's been ported to Switch. And it is like $5. And it is straight up heavily inspired by Link's Awakening from the original Game Boy. This feels like a game straight out of 1993. The theme is gardening. You are a master gardener trained by, you know, this guy that taught you how to be a great gardener. So all of the gear-gated elements are gardening tools, hoes and shovels and things like that. It's cute. It's a lot of fun. It's not overly difficult. I think I finished it in about 6 or 7, maybe 8 hours. And it's just got such charm in it. There's actually a portion of the game where you find a house that the two people living in it are the developers. And thank you for playing our game. And then you come to find out that other characters and animals in the games are named after their actual pets or their actual kids. And there's just so much love put into this game. And it's just a very delightful little game. And I highly, highly recommend that one.
Kudzu. It's full on like original Game Boy. Like it's monochromatic.
Yes.
Green. Look, very, very, very retro look to it.
And yeah, it's so retro that you can tell that some of the game was, you know, developed with the hardware limitations. Like some of the hitbox detection is just feels a little off. Like I got hit by that, but he was way over there. You know what I mean? And it doesn't detract from the game because, like I said, it's not overly difficult. But the dungeons are interesting because they're all outdoor. You know, you're used to Zelda where you go into a dungeon to explore, but all of theirs, since it's a gardening theme, are outside. So instead of it being a dungeon, it's an area. And I just little things like that. The music is exceptional. What they've been able to crank into the Game Boy chip tunes is outstanding. And for $5, this you can't go wrong with this game. It's really, really great.
That's called Kudzu, Kudzu. Mm-hmm. What else is on your playlist?
Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons. I played through the remake. Everybody's played that one, so I will say if you haven't played it, now is the time. Most of these remakes, I play them and I'm like, boy, that looks how I remembered it. This is one where I played it and I'm like, that looks a lot better than I remembered it. I would kind of argue maybe that game didn't need it, but this for me is a remake that is, for people that have never played it, that game still holds up. It is still powerful. There are some genuinely unsettling moments, even leading up to the finale. If you haven't checked that one out, play it. It's really, really good. And then lastly, last time I was here, I talked about Pinball FX, if you remember. Massive pinball fan. And I played this game called Slot Shots Pinball Ultimate Edition. This is the first time I was introduced to Slot Shots. And if you like pinball, this one is interesting for two reasons. The first is that there's an element of chance with the scoring, because every single one of these original tables, by the way, has a slot machine right in the middle of the table, right above the flippers. And there are things that you can do on the table to cause that to spin. And if you get certain things, you know, like three cherries or whatever, it boosts your score. So I kind of love that aspect of making a shot that's skillful, but also adding an element of luck to it. The other thing that I like about these pinball tables is that there's something like 20 tables or so. They're all unique, very unique, but they all, and this is going to may sound weird to explain, but they all have a similar point economy. And what I mean by that is if you play games on Pinball FX, one table might have a high score of like hundreds of millions of points. Another table might have tens of thousands of points, you know, like they just have different economies. And for the ones that I've played, they are all very similar. So if I get a good score on this table, I know what a good score on this table is going to be. And there's something about that that I really, really appreciate. So Slot Shots Pinball Ultimate Edition. It's really great. I played that on Steam Deck as well.
I got a million points. You're like, yeah, buddy, that's nothing. That's
yeah.
Yeah. There's the million points over here is like, you barely tried. Yeah.
Right.
I get you.
Like that Mars Attacks real pinball game. I don't know if you guys have played that one.
No.
Like it's in the trillions. Like it's just, you could drain the ball right off the bat and get 5 million points. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just, it's kind of brutal, but yeah, those are the games I've been playing.
So that's Slot Shots Pinball Ultimate Edition. Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, the remake, Kudzu, Mighty Mage, Mini Shoot Adventures, and Beat Slayer.
Yeah, can you tell I had spring break as well?
I love it. Love it. Christian Spicer, what is on your playlist?
So this is before I even knew there's this rumored rogue-type Prince of Persia game coming. There was a sale on Steam, Ubisoft again. They make all the games on all the systems, and their games always go on sale very quickly on all the systems as well. There was some Ubisoft sale on Steam, and I picked up Prince of Persia: The Sands of Time. This was a few months ago. I think it was $1.50 or $1.99 or something like that on Steam, and I had just come off The Lost Crown, maybe even more. That was January. So it's probably like February or March that this was on sale. And I was like, jumped on it, just absolutely jumped on it. And had spring break this week, had my out of town, had my Steam Deck with me. I was like, I am going, this is it. I'm not going to waste that $1.50. I'm going to play that game. One, speaking about game preservation, there are some hoops you have to jump through to play Sands of Time on Steam Deck. It is not a great PC port, I think, in general, in terms of playing on a current modern PC. It runs, but I don't think it supports widescreen, not super ultra wide, not super duper ultra, you know, Jeff's wraps around his head ultra wide. I'm talking 16:9. Like the PC port is, this is the era of 4:3 gaming, right? Like yeah. Maybe it supported 480p on GameCube if you had the cables, and maybe you could get it 16:9 if you held down the B button or whatever the GameCube, you know, code you had to do to hard boot it into that for the games that supported it. So the PC version still out of the box is 4:3. On Steam Deck, it doesn't recognize any of the controller inputs. It still thinks it's a mouse and keyboard game, which there are some games you arguably should play with mouse and keyboard. This is not one of them. I think even if you're a mouse and keyboard purist, this is not, Sands of Time is not one to play that way. And so I had to go into the Steam Deck settings, and it's great because the Steam Deck allows you to do all this. And I went into the community forums and I found a user created controller layout that worked well. And then if you wanted to, I didn't go this farther step, but then you could go in and download a mod for the game that would show you the prompts to accurately reflect the things that you're doing, where it's like, press F to let go of a ledge. Well, instead of pressing F, it's R3. And you know, you can update all that to have it properly display. I just kind of made my mental map of what to do and what buttons what. So there are some hoops you have to jump through to play this on a current PC. I'm not sure if it's available still on, you know, Xbox via backwards compatibility or not. If you have to pull out your old console to play it, it is, it's still on Xbox. This game is still absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. And in replaying it, it really highlighted to me how ahead of its time it was, even when it came out in whenever that was, 2002, 2001, whenever it first launched. In terms of its being very cinematic for this third, it's a third person action platformer in the 3D world where you would go into these environments and the camera would kind of zoom you through the environment. Like as you got into a traversal area or even a combat area, it takes you in through the room that you're in or the part of the palace that you're in, and it shows you where the four enemies are, or it shows you a run of what you need to do, like the poles and the cloth that you climb on and the wall that you do and where the exit is. It doesn't tell you how to get there or how to do it, but it shows you kind of everything. And then it allows you to experience that bespoke little puzzle box, so to speak. And then it layers in the time element where you get to rewind it and run it back and affect things in real time in order to progress. And playing that, I think it's 2003, whenever it is, playing that game again today, not only did so much of it stand the test of time in terms of its animations and the atmosphere that it's bringing to the game, to the experience, but also just the idea of the way that you encounter each challenge, I think is very much a thing that still exists in the zeitgeist today with a lot of the Souls likes, where you get into a room and it's like, okay, you know, crack your knuckles. This is going to be my challenge. This is going to be the thing that I do. Or the very cinematic stuff where it doesn't take the control out of your hands, but it pivots the camera in a way to show you as Ellie choking someone out as you're still doing it, but it gives you that cinematic view to really land that impact. Like Prince of Persia has those moments, Sands of Time, when you run and you do a big jump and you're still the one controlling it, but the camera would zoom around to show you from like an action movie perspective, landing this awesome, impossible jump. Blown away by how well the game held up, but it also really got me thinking about, I am very curious how much effort Ubisoft is putting into the rumored, or I guess announced, but backburnered remake of this.
Because no, it's coming out in 2021.
right alongside Splinter Cell.
No, they announced it originally that the remake of Sands of Time was coming out in 2021. In 2023, last year, they said it's still being worked on. So it's not been canceled, but it's been MIA for quite a while.
Well, that makes sense. They had to use the dagger and run it back and change some things. They didn't like what they were saying. But I'm super curious what this remake is, because I think there is a world where there could be a very, very ambitious, almost retelling of what this game is, where it's not just putting a shinier coat of paint on it, but like really examining what games are now today and making the combat encounters Souls like, or you know, some form of a, or even Prince of Persia the Lost Crown like, where any combat experience could be your death and any puzzle could be the end of a run. Because I think there's the fundamental pieces of that in the original game, but gaming now has progressed to a place where a lot of gamers are seeking out those challenges. And I'm very curious if they take this all the way down to the bones and remake it that way, or if it's kind of, no, we just made it so the game tells you to push R1 when you're letting go of a ledge or not. But it's, I was blown away. I mean, again, I paid $2 for it. But man, it's still an incredible, incredibly designed third-person action game.
It's interesting that you mentioned this game, because I picked up the same game for my Steam Deck right after Lost Crown, because I've never played it. So I'm about like 2/3 of the way through the game, and I'm shocked. So even as a person that didn't grow up with it, doesn't have the nostalgia, it still holds up. It's still really great. I will say I think the combat could use some updates. Because it's kind of the same thing over and over and over and over again.
Attack, attack, jump over attack.
Yes, exactly. And then it just becomes a thing of, well, there's just too many overwhelming. I can't even do the thing anymore because there's just so many guys, as opposed to, you know, what's the real skill here. But I'm loving it. And like I said, I've never played it. We have one of the bumpers on our show is Yuri doing his they say time is like a river. And I had never, so I just thought that was really cool. I fire up this game. That's like the opening line to the game. I was like, that's so cool. Like we did the line.
I think he actually says it. They say time is like a river.
Yes, that's exactly how it is. Yep, nailed it. Mm-hmm.
I remember loving Sands of Time back in the day, and I've been genuinely excited for this remake. I hope it happens. I hope it's well done. I hope it actually materializes. Maybe in a year where we get two Princes of Persia coming out, if both of them sell well and do well, it'll continue to incentivize Ubisoft to motivate this, you know, make it happen. So that's cool that you guys are both playing it. That's really a funny coincidence, and kind of throws sand in the face of my notion of, hey, too many Prince of Persia's in 1 year. Nope, yeah. We need more. No such thing as too many princes. One, two.
There
princes
it is.
Princes kneel before you.
I was waiting for it.
Head now. Anyway, on that note, before we get to my playlist, we got to take one more quick break for a sponsor. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Aura. Christian, you know, you and I live online. We're out there in the public eye. But have you ever had a family member that has Googled themselves or Googled their email address and just have been shocked by what they find?
It's always fun to look up like, oh, what are those pictures? Let's see if we can. That is OK. That's not what I was. OK. Yep. That is where I lived when I was 10. Like, why? Yeah. Why is that part of this? That is not cool.
It's creepy to know how much of your personal information is available, is exposed online all the time. It's pretty intimidating. And data brokers, they love it because they can sell your information to scammers, spammers, and anyone else that may want to target you. Your full name, your email, your home address, health records, your relatives, it's all out there.
You don't even need a major video game convention to list it for the world to see. It's already it's already out there.
That's right. That's right. Thanks, E3. That's why you should use Aura, the sponsor of today's show. Aura shows which data brokers are selling your information and automatically submits opt-out requests for you. Cleaning up your information not only helps reduce the amount of spam you get, but it protects you from hackers who could use this information to help them access your social media accounts, bank accounts, or other sensitive information. Aura also does so much more to protect you and your family from online threats that you can't see. You get other features like antivirus, VPN, password management, parental controls, identity theft insurance, and more without having to download several different apps. It's really easy to set up. And best of all, you get everything at one affordable price. You may already have one or two of these tools already, but not having Aura is like locking the front door and leaving the back door wide open. Aura is always on, doing the hard work of keeping you safe so you can focus on other tasks with peace of mind. I value my privacy, Christian. I know you do too. And I'm sure if you're listening, you value yours. So go to aura.com/DLC to start your 2-week free trial. Stop data brokers from exposing your personal information. Go to my sponsor, aura.com/DLC, to get a 14-day free trial and see how much of yours is being sold. aura.com/DLC for a 14-day free trial. All right. So last week, I talked about how Steam did a deck building fest, spotlighting all these deck building games. And I was like, oh man, how cool. I love deck builders. I'm all into it. I talked about some of my favorites from the deck building fest. The very next week, what does Steam do? Well, it's turn-based fest. Turn-based fest. Somebody at Steam is programming just to me. I don't understand it, but I appreciate it. Thank you, whoever is programming the fests because it's very much my jam.
So, this week's fest is Jeff's wife needs more alone time fest, I think is what it is. And it's just
really steam? Oh, okay.
She's already gotten that for 2 weeks in a row, Christian. these other fests taking up a lot of time. Anyway, I love turn-based video games, as anybody who listens to the show knows. So I dove in with gusto into a whole bunch of games. And again, anytime one of these fests happens, Next Fest or any of these fests, I am constantly just flabbergasted at the number of games there are being made on Steam. How does anybody make any money? I don't understand it. Only 8% of people are playing games that came out now, and there's 4 billion games coming out. Anyway, there's a bunch of games that I played during the turn-based fest. I'm going to talk about my two favorites. The first is a game called Dice Folk. Dice Folk, D-I-C-E-F-O-L-K, Dice Folk. This is a really clever idea. Dice is so prominent in the name, you'd think that dice had a bigger part in it. Quick side note, I forgot to mention this last week. Thank you, the thousands of you who have sent me emails that Slice and Dice is available on iOS. You can stop. I was aware of it at the time. I was talking about how it came out on Android longer ago, and it just came out on iOS and Steam. I picked it up on Steam. Yes, it is available on iOS. I think Slice and Dice is one of the best games I've played in a long time. Get it on iOS, but you can stop emailing me about it. I'm aware. I'm grateful. Thank you. I should have mentioned it at the time, but I've gotten quite a lot of those emails.
Thanks for that recommendation, by the way. I actually bought it.
It's so good, right?
It's so good.
A month from now, your son's going to come home and go, Dad, have you heard about slice type games? Have you heard about slice types?
I'm like, what? Like, you mean you like it's part lemon, part lime?
No, it's slice.io. I play on my Chromebook.
Anyway, Slice and Dice. I understand why Dice is in the title. Very much about dice. Dice Folk has dice in it, but that's not really why you come to the yard. It's got dice in it. The dice in Dice Folk are specialty dice. They have faces on them that indicate attacks or defense or other things. And yes, they are rolled every turn, but that's not what's cool about Dice Folk. What's cool about Dice Folk is that Dice Folk is kind of, it's got some Pokemon DNA in it, or at least wants to be a little Pokemon. You're collecting little critters, little creatures that you have in your stable, and you go to battle with those creatures, and you can bring up to 3 of them at a time. So your 3 critters are facing off against 3 other critters, and you're always in this triangle formation. And the triangles is always pointing from left to right. So there's the point of a triangle, meaning one of your characters is standing at the point, the other two are behind it, pointing to the right. The character that is on point is called the leader character. That's the only character that can attack. And also, well, that's not true, but it's the only character that can attack, the only character that's active at any given moment. But part of what you can do on your turn is rotate your triangle. So you've got 3 little critters that all have varying abilities and varying statistics, you know, attack and defense and magic and cool abilities. And so you're rolling little dice that queue up those attacks, but maybe your most powerful guy is in the back and can attack. So maybe one of the dice comes up that lets you rotate your triangle to get them in the front, so that when you queue up your attack, when you use up the attack die that you've rolled, the little attack face came up, the most powerful person does that attack. That's not even the coolest part, although that is a pretty cool part. I think that's a clever mechanic that I've never seen before, where you're like rotating your group so that the front person can be active. But that's not even the cleverest aspect of this game. It does something that I don't think I've ever seen before. You guys will probably correct me that I have seen it before, but I don't recall ever seeing this before. You are
controlling your team and the bad guys. You are controlling the bad guys. So you are every fight you're in, you control your team and the opposing team. So dice are rolled for your team and the bad guys. And the bad guys will have three dice that give them abilities to do that turn. And you have to use all those dice before the round is over. So you're deciding when they attack, who they attack, how they attack, whether they defend. But you have to use all the faces that come up on those dice. So even if it's a really powerful attack, you're like, which of my guys am I going to use that on? So you're deciding, and you can do it in any order. You can have your guys do some stuff, their guys do some stuff, vice versa, any order. One of my guys, then one of their guys, back and forth, rotating your team. So you're deciding like who of your team gets the damage, who of their team gets the damage, and you're kind of sorting all that out in real time, rotating their triangle, rotating your triangle. And sometimes the dice faces will be like, rotate a random direction. You're like, oh boy, here we go. I don't know if they're going to get me a worse bad guy. It's going to rotate into a worse bad guy or an easier one. It's clever. It's a really clever concept I've never seen before, where you are in complete control over both sides of the fight. You just have to figure out the little puzzle of it and how to best proc all of the little dice faces that have rolled up. In what order, in order to make it most beneficial to you. Really clever. Really clever game. That's called Dice Folk. Highly impressed by it. It's got a cute art style. Again, it's very Pokemon. You're moving through this little grid from place to place, you know, procking fight. Very roguelite, standard Slay the Spire style, like moving through the flowchart. Except this one, you can like backtrack and go other ways. And certain of the nodes in that flowchart will unlock new little Pokemon type creatures that you can add to your stable and then level them up and use them in certain ways. Clever. Very cool game. Dice Folk.
Looks great.
Yeah. The other game that took me completely by surprise, and I am completely enamored with this game. I love it. I love it so very much. And I can't explain why it's taken me by storm so much. This game is called Economics. Economics, like a gnome. So it's Economix. Economics. This is ostensibly like a resource management city builder kind of game. Very charming art style, I think. It looks like claymation to me. And you're controlling a group of gnomes who delve deep underground. And every layer they go down gets more challenging as they go down. You've got this little like platform on a rope, and it's lowering down into the depths of this mine. And you have different gnomes that you can recruit, that you can purchase to be part of your little group of gnomes. And it takes place on this isometric, very small grid-like kind of diamond-shaped, well, they're not all diamond-shaped, but you get my drift. They're like these little diorama-looking things. They're very small, very contained. And on them, on the little platforms, on the little grids, there are creatures like chickens and other little creatures that you can harvest for food. There are plants that you can chop down and harvest for other kinds of resources. There's little specialty things that'll like hop around, and you can try to attack those that'll spew out other resources. Anyway, you're collecting different kinds of resources as you go down deeper into the mine. The farther you go down, the better the resources get. But after a certain number of turns inside each layer, bats will fly through the cavern and steal your food. And if they steal all of your food, if you get down to zero food, you have to go back to the top. Your run is over. And you have to go back to, you have to pull out of the mine and go back to the top. So you're trying to maintain enough food to keep going deeper while also getting a bunch of resources that you can use you know, one of the resources is food that you can use immediately, and you can buy things during your run as you go down and upgrade your guys and add more guys. But also you'll pull those resources back up at the top when you're done to build buildings at the surface that will increase your tech tree, allow you to build newer, cooler things, have cooler kinds of gnomes that do cooler kinds of things. Hunters will attack food, and you can get them like flaming swords that will immediately cook the food as you kill it, so that it will feed more bats, basically. Anyway, you're going deeper and deeper. But the key feature of this is that when you click the go button on a turn, you've set up, you've put your gnomes where you want on different grids on this space, and when you press go, they go for 7 turns each time you say go. And the 7 turns are chop a tree, chop a tree, chop a tree, chop a tree, you know, 7 times, or shoot an arrow, shoot an arrow, shoot an arrow, 7. But they have to have the thing that they are harvesting in proximity to them each of those 7 turns, or they have nothing to do. Now, there's certain ways to get them to move. There's certain ways to power them up so that if they have nothing to do, they actually do something cool. There's all these different ways to mitigate that. But ultimately, it's like placing gnomes in a space that is most advantageous for each of the 7 turns that they go in one go.
I'm looking at the video. Do you have to kind of like lead those attacks? Do you have to like kind of anticipate where they're going, or do they just automatically attack what they're going for?
They automatically attack the best possible target in their range.
Okay.
So you'll know where their range is when you place them. And there's certain things you can do to expand their range, to change their range, but you place them and you know what stuff is around them at any given time. And again, there's other stuff that moves. There's some stuff that moves when you smack it. So like your hunter will smack it with an axe and it'll move away from them, but then it'll move back on the subsequent turn. So like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, it's hopping around as your guys are standing in place, smacking it. There's something just so satisfying about this game that I can't really explain. I love how it looks. I love how it feels. I love the push your luck element, but it's also like kind of a cozy game that makes me feel good. The penalties aren't super harsh. Like my gnomes don't get murdered. You know, oh, the other thing I forgot to mention is parts of the grid will crumble turn to turn. So your gnomes always have little propellers on their back, so they'll never fall to their death. But if the land underneath them crumbles, then they can't do anything. So you've put them in a bad spot, and then they can't harvest anything because now they're just holding on to their propeller backpack. Although there's an upgrade that lets you upgrade them to be able to mine while they're hovering. Anyway, I just love this game. I love this game. It's called Echonomics. I have no idea if my explanation makes it sound fun at all, but it is really fun. It's a delight. And you at the surface, you're building new buildings. You're turning, you know, just the raw wood that you get into planks, or you're bottling things into bottles, and there's a whole tech tree on the surface level that lets you make even cooler stuff down below. And you've got better and better gnomes. Like you can get a gnome that releases a beaver, and the beaver will like do things every turn. And it's just so cute and clever and fun and addictive. Game. It's a delight. It's called Echonomics.
I'm definitely intrigued by this one.
Out. I'm looking at its Steam page and it says no, it is to not be announced.
They were having a demo for the
fest.
For the fest, which is how I played it. It's a very robust demo, but this one is 100% a day one purchase for me when it finally hits Steam. I don't think it has a release date yet, but I'm in love with it.
Do you think the art style alone is fantastic? It kind of reminds me of the remake of Link to the Past.
Yes, that like kind of claymation-y look, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Just do you think they're squat little characters that kind of look like they're modeled out of clay, or they're little. It's a great game.
Do you think this is going to be playable on Steam Deck? I'm a Mac guy, so I don't have a mouse and keyboard PC. It looks very mouse heavy in what I'm seeing, but maybe you could manipulate it with a stick.
I suspect you could manipulate with a stick, but also, you know, Steam Deck lets you do a mouse, you know, with the thumb pad thingy. I
that
know
thing
it's
is
not
so
great,
sensitive.
It, yeah. I mean, that's how I played all of Slice and Dice was with that. So.
Oh, really?
It's on iOS. It's on iOS.
Wait, what? Slice and Dice is?
Yeah. Did you know that?
No. I wish somebody had emailed me about it.
Yeah. I'm a big Slice type gamer.
Yeah. I knew that about you. Slice OS. Slice
me,
IO.
Hey, if there's a game named after a catchphrase from the Dark Knight graphic novel, I'm in. You know? That's all I need. That's all I need.
All right. Well, on that note, I think we can wrap up the show.
Slice and dice.
Super fun. Super fun episode. Scott L. Clark, thank you for being here. So much fun talking with you. And really great you bring in so many cool games that weren't on my radar at all to the table. Very fun. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me. It is. It was so much fun last time. It was even more fun this time. I got to talk to Christian as well. Thank you so much for having me. I really, really enjoyed it.
Of course. Tell folks where they can keep up with you and the cool stuff you do online.
Absolutely. Our website is thegamingoutsider.com. That's where you can find all of our written content as well as our podcast. But if you want to hear the show, you can hear that wherever you listen to shows. Spotify, Apple Podcasts. I can't remember what's the proper name now. It's not iTunes. It's Apple Podcasts, right? I can't keep track of it
not
all,
me.
But yeah. Check that out. We have a Discord. There's a link for that on our server. We got a Facebook group /TheGoCast. Would love to interact with anybody. I actually got a couple new people to chat with from the last time. A guy by the name of Doc Sampson in particular is a big pinball guy. And he nice. And I have been chatting ever since he heard me on the last episode. So thank you for the opportunity. Also, keep an eye out on thegamingoutsider.com. We are actually in the process of doing our third video game convention here in the city of Rockford. I am so excited. We have a brand new venue. It's going to be like four times the space. We're doing it for two days instead of one day.
Wow.
It is so awesome. I actually got contacted by the venue. They said they heard about the event and they wanted us to have it at their place. They want us to come back every year. So they gave us a really good rate. We're already talking to like Stern Pinball about coming to bring some tables because they're here in Chicago and we're looking for VIPs, looking for vendors. I was actually at the Midwest Gaming Classic yesterday, meeting all of the, trying to get in front of some vendors, and we saw some that we actually had at our last convention, and they were like, when are you having it again? We want to come back, give us the date. And so very, that's very great. Excited, really looking forward to it. So please, it's going to be called R2V2. It's the Rock River Valley Video Game Convention. So, but you can find all that info once it's up at thegamingoutsider.com.
Very, very cool. And then you go, you bring your collection and you go like, honey, I got to have the collection to bring to the convention.
I know, right?
The people to see.
I don't know how I would move 700 or 800 cartridges easily over
honey,
to a convention.
I need the U-Haul truck.
Exactly.
You have to own it in order.
Well, you just download them off the internet, put them on a flash drive.
Oh, yeah.
Oops.
Christian Spicer, what do you got going on this week?
Not winning the lottery yet again. Boo. I read a newsletter about not winning the lottery that you can about video games, casual conversations about video games.
That would
games.
Be a hilarious newsletter, though.
That
just
would...
like April 8th.
Dude.
Nope. Not again. Again. No.
Like strategies, you know, like here's what.
8.
Well.
12. 42. 63. 11. Didn't win again.
Someone emails you, dear Christian, thank you for your numbers last week. I used them this week and I won. Oh no.
Newest newsletter. All my friends' birthday dates are unlucky.
Getting a new group of friends, need new numbers. It is about video games, casual conversations about video games. And the one I'm working on right now is about esports, and I'm trying to actually pull some data whether or not I actually go down that rabbit hole or not, but the rise and plateau and seeming not fall but change of the money in esports space is thoughts I'm wrestling with right now. So that's on Substack. You can find it at christianspicer.substack.com. And then this show is on Threads and Instagram as DLC Hype Train. We also put up video segments of the show on YouTube, which is at DLC Pod.
You can listen to me on other podcasts. I do a movie and TV show review show called The Film Cast. This week we're talking about Monkey Man, Dev Patel's directorial debut. I do a comedy science show called We Have Concerns with Anthony Carboni. I do a sports show called The Fan Controlled Show at Fan Controlled Sports and Entertainment. And The Book Club with Lana Bashinsky. We're talking about the Melazin Book of the Fallen and all kinds of other cool stuff. So check those out wherever you get fine podcasts. Except for that last one, you have to go to my YouTube channel. Or if you're a patron, you get the audio version. But yeah, very cool. You can follow me on socials at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. All right, let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts.
Hey, give us a suggestion.
Scott, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
I do. If you can't tell from my playlist, I like to keep myself very busy. Being a school teacher, trying to keep up with video games, running a DJ business, I do not like to sit down and do nothing. And that has caught up with me. I'm actually seeing a therapist to learn how to relax a little bit. And one of the things that he recommended to me was meditation. And I had no idea where to start. Absolutely no idea where to start. And one of my colleagues recommended an app to me that is called Headspace. And I'm going to start by saying that I am not sponsored by this app. It is a paid subscription app, but I mentioned it because it is free to teachers, I found out. So if there are any teachers listening, this is a free app. And it's really great. It has a lot of tools available for you to meditate. It teaches you how to breathe correctly. It's basically look at the screen and follow these breathing exercises, and you can just do it for like 3 minutes a day and kind of center yourself, and that helps. And it even has things to help you sleep. Sometimes I have trouble staying asleep or sleeping well, so it does like these ambient noises or somebody talking to you to kind of like lull you to sleep, and then it just turns off after you're asleep. It's just a really great way to put your head in a good space, which is why it's a great app name. I highly recommend it. It's a good place to kind of get you back to where you need to be if you are stressed out.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. That's Headspace. Christian Spicer, what is your parting gift?
Like I did with Bayside's new album, which is out now in full, I want to plant a flag for an upcoming album. The Early November, a band I love very much and was very fortunate to see and hang out with back in the day. They are putting out a new album, and it's coming out in June. Two singles are already out from it. I know. Well, look, if it came out in November, you wouldn't be able to find it because you'd be like, Early November, when does it come out? June. That makes sense. The Early November, and I think the album is just, I think it's self-titled. I think it's just called The Early November. They're great. These two lead singles, or I don't even know if they're called singles anymore. The two songs that you can currently listen to on your streaming service of choice, I think are really cool and a really fun evolution of the band. And so if you liked them before and maybe you're like, oh, I forgot about them, put it on your radar. In June, I believe, is when The Early November's new album is coming out. In June is when The Early November's new album is
I heard they're out. Touring with the Decemberists at some point.
Only during the summer, though. That's the only time you can see them.
Yeah, in Green Day, yeah. They're going to just play nothing but Wake Me Up When September Ends. I got to thank you, Christian, for your music recommendations. Every time you recommend something, I immediately go to my phone and check it out because your recommendations are awesome. You were the reason that I discovered that Incubus did things before Make Yourself. I have listened to Science on repeat for the past couple of years. It's so good.
So Science is good. It goes hard. Yeah, it goes hard.
Love that album.
My parting gift is a new show that just hit Netflix. It's called Ripley. And this is actually a remake of The Talented Mr. Ripley. Or not, that's not accurate. Not a remake. It's a also adapting the same source material that that movie did, but doing it over the course of 8-hour-long episodes instead of 1 2-hour-long movie, and therefore has much more time to luxuriate in what is, in this show, some of the most beautiful cinematography and locations I have ever seen put on film. Ripley is all shot in black and white, and it is stunning. Stunning. It also features one of my favorite actors working today, Andrew Scott, who is so good in the show. So good. It's a period piece. It takes place in the 60s, shot almost entirely in Italy, and makes Italy look, I mean, Italy needs no help, but it makes it look absolutely gorgeous, especially in that black and white photography. This is an amazing show. Amazing show. I don't think it's even compares to the movie. Like, they're just completely different pieces of art. And so if you're like, I already saw it when that movie, I urge you to try Ripley on Netflix. It's just watch it on a big screen if you can and fall into the photography. It's just stunning, but the acting is also great. And it's a kind of a creepy, interesting, cool story. I'm so impressed with the show, Ripley on Netflix. We also got a listener-suggested parting gift. This was sent to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. It comes from Aaron Trahan, who I believe was a Hype Train patron, or maybe still is. Aaron says, my listener-suggested parting gift is episode 1 of the sketch comedy series from YouTube, the YouTube channel Good Girl Studios. I met Josh Francis while doing comedy in San Diego. He moved away, and I've been following his progress as he and his team have been making amazing sketches. Thank you for everything. Yeah, there's a sketch show on Good Girl Studios from YouTube that Aaron is recommending highly. Josh Francis is one of the people behind it, and that's his parting gift. Thank you, Aaron, for sending that along. Christian, I know you were big in the San Diego comedy scene at one time. Maybe these guys are after your time.
They are a little after my time, but I have watched some other videos. What?
As I said, because you're old like me.
Oh, no. Look, I was in San Diego in the early November, and I left before September ended.
Weirdly, these guys came out in June? I don't get it. Anyway, if you'd like to have your parting gift on our show, please send it to us. dlcfeedback@gmail.com is where you send those. And that's it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Scott L. Clark and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those fun bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. You can get swag for the show, hats and t-shirts, cool logo stuff, by going to store.dlcpod.com. Our biggest thanks are always reserved for our patrons who make this show possible. Without them, we would not be doing it. So thank you, patrons. You can become one at patreon.com/dlcpod. But our top tier patrons, our Hype Train patrons, they become video games. I love this part of the show where we talk about classic games. Do you remember Adam Denby?
I was talking about replaying Sands of Time. Mm-hmm. Another game I've been replaying is Home Run Denby. I don't know if you ever played.
Yes. Yes. It's by the way, it's much easier to hit a home run in your den. You know what I mean? Such a smaller space. But it was that the earliest of the waggle games, right? The earliest of the, you know, Wii Sports. We were bowling. What were we doing? We were dancing, we were balance boarding, and we were also hitting home runs in the Home Run Denby.
I mean, it's also the era of like backyard baseball, yeah. NBA Street. And it was like, right. what new genre can we do? And Adam was like, we're playing in our den. You know, yeah. it's we're hitting Home Run Denbys. And it really recreated a thing we've all done before, like the wadded up paper, paper towel roll. You know, it felt like that the weight of a Wiimote was a right proximity of the paper towel roll. So I was I was in Denby's all day, you know, just the Denby after Denby.
The funniest, the best part when this game came out are all the viral videos of people just destroying their dens, you know, but and they accidentally let go of the Wiimote and it just flew into the, you know, what do you have in a den? I don't know.
I mean, my favorite tagline was, I broke my TV, but at least I hit a Denby. You know, I thought that was clever.
That was pretty good. That's pretty good. yeah, you were I was smacking dingers in the den all day long. Dingers in the den. It's a home run, Denby. It's a great game. It's a great game. Also, great game was, you know, I personally am not into World War II reenactment games, you know, but I did enjoy the Hank Patton game because I didn't know that General Patton had a cousin who was very instrumental in not going into World War II. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, everybody talks about General Patton, of course, famous, incredible military mind,
yeah,
strategist. And people also like to talk about Hanky Panky. And so, you know, which is like you trying to get away with it, right? You have to be a strategist when sure. you're younger and you're living at home and your significant other is coming over. And this is pre Netflix and chill. This is like you go to Blockbuster and you have to come over. And it was a real strategy to be able to pull off Hank Patton. And it wasn't always. And I think the game replicated that really well. It was kind of like, you know, like Home Alone, the movie, not the video game. You have to construct these traps to keep your parents out of your room.
Thirst traps.
you know, it's like keep the door open. And it's like, I'll keep the door open. But there's a bunch of micro machines on the floor to pull off a successful Hank Patton. It was really great.
The strategy was really cool. it was like, what if somebody took Command and Conquer and mixed it with Leisure Suit Larry? You know, which nobody had thought to do before. Hank Patton,
Hanky, which also was just Patton, called Command and Conquer. Still,
Hanky Panky Patton. It was one of my favorites. Even though I couldn't answer the three questions that I needed to play it. You know, it had that. That thing at the beginning, you had to answer those three questions before you could play it.
Yeah, the age gating. It was well done. It was rough. It was.
The problem
was
they were
come in and answer them.
They were intense. They were very deep World War II strategy questions.
Well, they knew that little kids wouldn't know that yet, right? Again, this isn't the era of
at the 38th parallel, which I don't even know. That's I think it's
well now. Of course, everybody listens to hardcore history. Everybody, all kids know the answers to those questions.
Not
but back then.
Then,
it was like we only had the one chapter in our history book about World War II.
Yeah,
you know, the kids didn't know the answers to that. We just wanted to get straight to the hanky panky. But little did we know, we had to provide the patent.
I read it. I played that game for the articles. I played that game for the strategy. You know what I'm saying? Hanky panky was just it was just gravy. And there was that really game, very disgusting gravy moment.
I bought that game on vacation, and I spent hours just reading the instruction manual before I could even play it.
First time. You don't want your parents to see you reading the Hanky Panky Patton instruction manual.
No. Yeah.
The field guide, they called it.
The feel-good field guide, I think, is
the feel-yourself guide. Well, this took a turn, but we're still grateful for Adam Denby and Hank Patton for being our hype train level patrons. They get to become video games. You can too by supporting the show at the high level of hype train at patreon.com/DLCpod.
We hit those out of the park. We just hit some Denbys. Those were great.
That was like a home run Denby right there. All right. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.